welcome to another episode of Soundography, a crash course in music, one band at a time. My name is Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And today we are talking about a band that some people could ask, why so serious?
The band is
Muse. And it's funny that we're recording this. Now, here's a little secret on how the sausage is made. We're recording this about a week and a day before I'm actually going to see Muse live, but we're releasing this about 2 weeks after I see Muse live. So the release of this is going to be, the concert's going to be sandwiched right in between the time that we record this and the time that we release it. And we decided that this would be good because, number one, you know, I'll be listening to Muse and getting ready for the concert. Perfect timing anyway. And then those people who did see them in concert can kind of look back and say, oh yeah, I love that song. And oh yeah, I remember that album and stuff like that. So there you go.
I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I am too. I really, really enjoyed this week. I enjoyed it. I knew I was going to enjoy it because I do really like Muse. And, but I've always listened to Muse in smaller doses, an album here, a few songs there. I've never listened to multiple Muse albums, like one right after the other. And one thing you notice when you do that is that they're, number one, obviously very consistent, something we talked about on the show, mm-hmm. whether it's better to be consistent or better to evolve with every album. And there is some evolution. So, you know, that's, I'm not saying that they've remained stagnant.
Yeah.
But
each album has a personality, and I'm great with that.
It totally does. And, but anyway, so regardless, I really, really enjoyed this week. And oh, the second thing I noticed is that, with few exceptions, they always feel like they're at level 8 or higher.
Mm-hmm.
Which again, I'm still fine with. I like that, I like that a lot. So let's get into this. Let's talk about the band Muse.
Well, before we jump too into it, I do want to throw out, this is a band that tours a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. According to the when I was doing research on this, they're on tour all the time. Hmm. So I did not mention a lot of the tours because it would have been the Muse show about the tours instead of the Muse show
just
about
like
the
one tour after another. And then in 1999, they went on tour with this album. And then in 2003, okay.
So I didn't mean to short shrift them on the tours because they are a touring powerhouse, and we'll find out a few opinions of that later in the show.
Sure.
But I didn't want to make it a Muse tour documentary.
Cool. I think that works. And I think that, that information's out there. You know, if people really want to know how often a band tours, it's not hard for them to find that information. So I'm with you. It's fine. It's fine, Hammond. It's fine. It's fine.
I just wanted to put that out there because there are going to be Muse purists that maybe are wondering why I don't bring up the tours as much as we do.
Okay. Well, we're going to bring up some of them.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Sure. All right, let's talk about them. They're an English rock band formed in Teignmouth in Devon. Formed in 1994 by Matt Bellamy on vocals, Chris Wolstenholme, and Dominic Howard. Initially, all the members had been in other school bands. When they first got together, they called themselves Rocket Baby Dolls. Yeah. You know, I love the early band names.
Oh, yeah.
They adopted a goth glam image, and in 1994, they won a local Battle of the Bands. After winning, they started taking themselves and what they were doing a little bit more seriously, and then they changed their name to Muse and started working on material.
I'm wondering if they were patting themselves after, like, the New York Dolls.
Oh, I don't know.
Glam band with the Rocket Baby Dolls.
Sure, with a little bit of a goth image. Mm-hmm. Possibly, but boy, I mean, musically, you couldn't, I don't think you could.
I don't know what Rocket Baby Doll sounds like. It could be...
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, it would have the sound would have definitely evolved from mm-hmm. Rocket Baby Dolls. I don't think so. I mean, I think it's one of those things. It's like let's the Baby Dolls. Oh, it's added a word, Rocket Baby Dolls. Oh, perfect. Let's call ourselves that. You know,
because we're explosive.
Right, exactly. After a few years of building a fan base, they started playing shows in London and Manchester. They met with Dennis Smith, who owned Sawmill Studio. That meeting led them to their first serious recordings and the release of their first EP titled Muse, the Muse EP, in 1998. They released the Muscle Museum EP in 1999. It reached number 3 in the indie singles chart and attracted the attention of radio broadcaster Steve Lamacq. In late 1999, they performed on the emerging artist stage at Woodstock 99.
This is not in Woodstock 94. Woodstock 94 is the one we have the biggest trend with. Oh,
that's right.
When I typed it in, I started giggling too, but then I realized that 99 and 94 are two different shows.
They really are. Even though they had success with their EPs, many companies were reluctant to sign them. After a trip to New York, they met with several well-known people in the industry, including Tim Feving and Rick Rubin. In late 1998, they signed with Maverick Records.
Which I think is actually Madonna's label, isn't it?
I think so. I think that is right, yeah. Is it her? Is it just the label she's on, or is Maverick Records owned by her?
I think it's her thing, to be honest with you. I'm not an expert in this one, but I think she's definitely mixed up in it somehow.
Yeah, no, she founded it in 1992 with Frederick DeMann and Veronica Deshev. It's a subsidiary of Warner, but there's Maverick Records, Maverick Films, book publishing, music publishing, a Latin record division that's all part of this thing, and Madonna's at the very top of this this whole business.
They have a children's group called Mother Goose, and they have to buzz the tower before they do any flight before they
jeez, that's a long that was a long walk to a Top Gun joke. By the way, Madonna is no longer involved in it as of 2004. There was a lawsuit between Maverick and Warner, so Madonna and Deshev left, and DeMann was bought out in 1998 by Guy Osiri. So it may have started out as a Madonna thing, but she's no longer involved. By the way, the name Maverick comes from Madonna, Veronica, and Frederick Maverick.
Wow. Okay.
Pretty cool.
Before we jump into the albums, I want to say this.
Of course. Sure.
Am I really, really stupid, or is there some Coldplay mixed up in the sound of these guys?
And are those the only choices you're going to give me?
Sadly, yes.
I didn't hear it, and I listened after I read your note about that, and I still didn't hear it. I hear a lot of Queen, obviously.
Yeah.
I hear Suede, UK Suede, and I hear a little bit of maybe some of that, just the general Brit pop that was oozing in there, like Oasis, a little bit of Blur, a little bit of Jarvis Cocker. I mean, that. You know,
so I felt
residual sound of the 90s, but
I felt a little vindicated, because when we talked about Coldplay with Christy, we mentioned Radiohead a lot, and this album we're about to talk to did draw a lot of comparisons to Radiohead. So I felt a little vindicated in that.
Sure.
But for whatever reason, I was having yellow flashbacks when when I was listening to this first album.
You know, maybe for me, the vocals break that connection. So to the point where I can't hear it in the instrumentation.
Right.
Like if you're hearing it in the arrangements, I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, the Matt Bellamy's vocals pull me away from any comparisons.
Okay, and that might be where I am is musically. I'm hearing it, but not vocally.
Sure.
I just, my first instinct was, holy crap, I'm having yellow flashbacks.
YPSD or something. In 1999, the band released their first actual album called Showbiz. Of course, this showcased Bellamy's falsetto and his melancholic alt-rock style, or the band's melancholic alt-rock style. The album reached number 29 on the UK album charts. There was more experimental music written, but it was held off of the album to be used as B-sides for the singles that were going to be released. As you mentioned, the album did draw comparisons to Radiohead, and one reviewer said, quote, "Showbiz is not as clever as they think it is." Nah, I really liked it, actually.
I think I enjoyed this album actually a lot more than I thought I was going to.
For as far as first albums go, and we've listened to quite a few first albums on the show, this one felt like it could have been later on in their career. Mm-hmm. Like it felt established. It felt It felt like it came from a band that had some years under its belt and knew what they were doing. So to be able to come out with a debut album, and I know they had a couple EPs beforehand, but to be able to come out with a debut album that solid, I think deserves kudos for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In 2000, they released Random 1-8 EP, which was released in Japan only. It contained 6 B-sides recorded during the showbiz sessions and 2 live tracks. So there you go. It's an 8-track EP. In 2001, they released the album Origin of Symmetry, which showed an expanding sound for the band. It incorporated more instrumentation and more diverse influences, as well as showing the band starting to experiment with other instruments, such as a mellotron, a church organ, and other percussion instruments. More Hendrix and Morello were evident in the riff-based songs on the album, and it features a cover of Feeling Good, originally done by Anthony Newley and Leslie Bercuse, very famously recorded by Nina Simone. Probably the best known version of that song is by Nina Simone.
So when I was doing my playlist, I felt like just dropping the song in your list automatically.
Because you knew.
Then I actually typed it in and then put, well, duh. And then I decided not to be presumptuous because you might not like this version, which
right.
I still don't know if you do or not. We haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, I guess we'll find out. Boy,
but I did. I almost did just drop it in there and go, well, duh. But I decided not to.
So that cover, by the way, was released as as part of a double A-side single with the song Hyper Music. Now, overall, the album was given positive reviews. Maverick, which was Muse's American label, as we mentioned, didn't consider Bellamy's vocals, quote-unquote, radio-friendly, and asked Muse to re-record the song for the U.S. release. The band refused and left Maverick. The album was not released in the U.S. until September 2005, after Muse was signed to Warner Brothers.
So what would they want him to do differently? Did they want him to growl it? Did they want him to rap it? What would they want him to do?
Because I think there are a couple songs on that album where his falsetto is just super, super high. And I know one of the songs, I'm pulling it up because I remember when Tina and I were listening to this. Shoot, what is it? Was it Plug-In Baby? There was one where we were both saying, man, I love the arrangement on this song. I love the instrumentation. But man, his vocals are really high. And it's spoken and it's sung into a... like a vocoder or something that's giving it some major distortion. And I wouldn't say it was like a turnoff for us, but it was definitely, it took some getting used to hearing that sound. Anyway, in 2002, they released a live DVD called Hullabaloo. It was recorded during 2 shows in Paris. It also contained a documentary film of the tour. A double album was released along with the DVD, and it contained B-sides and other songs from the shows at Le Zénith. A double A-side single was released with In Your World and Dead Star. And also in 2002, they threatened Celine Dion with legal action when she planned to call her Vegas show Muse, despite the band owning the worldwide performing rights to the name.
She should know better than that.
She should, totally. Her cease and desist will go on. she did offer them $50,000 for the rights to the name, but they turned it down. Bellamy said, "We don't want to turn up there with people thinking that we're Celine Dion's backing band." I think that's a valid.
Yeah.
That's absolutely a valid thing. Like, if I were going to, like, 2 things. Number one, if I were going to Vegas and I saw a sign that said Muse and maybe had a very stylized picture of Celine Dion where I didn't recognize it to be Celine Dion, I'd be like, oh, awesome. That's Muse is playing. I'm going to go see him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people who aren't familiar with Muse, but are familiar with Celine Dion and see her show are thinking, oh, cool. The rest of her band is going to be playing at the Cosmopolitan. I'm going to have to go see them after I see her at Caesars.
Yeah. Celine Dion and the Muses.
Yes. So Celine Dion is not a muse.
No, she's not amused.
Not amused. 2003, they released the album Absolution, which saw even more classical influences added into their overall style. They included an orchestra on Butterflies and Hurricanes. This also marked the first of 5 consecutive number one albums in the UK.
Okay, I jump into this, I want to ask this. Okay, what is the difference between UK tastes and United States tastes? Because they've killed it in the UK consistently, and they've been the United States market has been a harder nut for them to crack. Why?
I think I mean, as a guess, I think that the listening audiences, and specifically, I would say it's the younger crowd, probably has a different need for their music. I think, and again, this is complete and total speculation on my part, but when you look at what was popular in the late 90s, early 2000s in the United States, it was a lot of dance stuff. It was a lot of that stuff that was kind of carried over from the 90s, you know, your Black Eyed Peas and maybe the emergence of Pitbull and stuff like that. And we were very heavily into dance music. And when I say we, I'm not counting myself as part of that we.
Yeah, I was too far down a Dream Theater hole.
I'm sure you were. Let me take a drink. Somebody's got to do it. Whereas I think I certainly don't want to make it a comparison of like, well, the UK's tastes are more refined and American tastes are crap.
No, my thought was that they seem to be willing to more willing to take a risk in what they listen to.
Yeah.
And I think it just might commercially be more willing to take risks. And maybe that's all it is.
Maybe. Maybe. I don't know. But I find myself leaning more towards the tastes that the UK markets have. Whatever the case is, that the UK loves their muse.
Mm-hmm.
So 2003, we were talking about Absolution. This album produced their first top 10 hit, Time Is Running Out, and three top 20 hits with Hysteria, Sing for Absolution, and Butterflies and Hurricanes. Love this album, and Hysteria is such a great song, and I almost included it in my playlist, but I limited myself to just one greatest hit. And Hysteria definitely is one of their greatest hits.
So since they don't have a greatest hits album, I just kind of went crazy. I have no idea if my stuff was greatest hits or not. I just went with it.
Good. Yeah, you know, that's true. I mean, I guess, you know, it was obviously a top 10 single for them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's true, they don't have a greatest hits album, which means that, you know, when we link to something for their for the Amazon link on the show notes, we'll probably link to just one of their albums.
I'm thinking probably one of their live tours.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because like this 2005 Glastonbury show that we're going to
talk about. It does have a lot of their...
It's a really, really good live album from what I gather.
Yeah, for sure. So the album Absolution was certified gold. They went on a tour in support of the album. And in 2003, they sued Nestle for using their cover Feeling Good for a Nescafe ad without permission. They donated the money that they won from that suit to Oxfam. That's funny. You'd think Nestle would know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean.
So it paints them as a kind of a litigious and protective band of their own brand, though, doesn't it? Not in a bad way, but in a very protective way.
But neither of these, you know, neither the Celine Dion thing or the Nestle thing seem superfluous or frivolous.
No.
One of them seem like, you know, and that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, there's a difference between being litigious and frivolous.
Yes.
With your lawsuits. I would, in both cases, I would have done exactly mm-hmm. what they
no,
did.
I'm not being disparaging at all. If that's, that was the takeaway, I just was thinking, man, they are super protective of their brand.
Sure. Good. And good for them.
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, Muse won two MTV Europe Awards, including Best Alternative Act and a Q Award for Best Live Act.
I don't want to win a P Award.
Q, by the way, is a British music magazine that I love. I love Q Magazine, especially when they used to have cover albums glued to the front of it. You could go to Barnes & Noble and get the most recent Q Magazine, and it would have a really cool cover album glued to the front. Sometimes you'd get there, and somebody ripped off all of the albums from the front of those. Like, you could see that it was torn off because it, like, the glue tore the cover of the magazine. I just
hate when people do that. People.
Silently cursed those people who did that. In 2005, they released another live DVD for the Absolution Tour. It contained performances from the Glastonbury performance. In 2006, they released the album Black Holes and Revelations, which incorporated electronic and pop elements and showed an influence of bands like Depeche Mode, for example, on the song Supermassive Black Hole.
This has a real strong, like, Euro pop, like you said, Depeche Mode, New Order kind of influences on it that I really, really liked in conjunction with their music and their sound.
I think so too. Yeah, definitely noticed that. This album brought them wider international notice and success, and it reached number 9 on the US charts, but of course, as we mentioned earlier, number 1 in the UK and some other countries. By the way, the song on here, Soldier's Poem. Absolutely is a Lost Queen song. They've got a harmony, a couple bits of harmony in there that sound like Mercury, May, and Roger Taylor, like the traditional Queen harmonies that that you remember from their music. The album was nominated for a 2006 Mercury Music Award, but it lost to the Arctic Monkeys. It went platinum in Europe. Starlight, Knights of Sidonia, and Invincible were released as singles. And in the summer of 2007, they released Map of the Problematic, or Problematique, as a download-only single. A year later, in 2008, they released Harp, H-A-A-R-P. It documented their performance at Wembley Stadium, and they were the first band to sell out after Wembley was rebuilt. NME, New Musical Express, named the release the 40th greatest live album of all time. And in August of 2008, all three members of the band were granted honorary doctorates of the arts by the University of Plymouth for their contributions to music.
I want an honorary doctorate for something.
Right? I know. It feels like they just hand those out. I want to be the honorary doctorate of cover song knowledge. Dr. Covers.
Dr. Covers.
Dr. Covers.
Sounds like a late night call-in show from the 70s.
Hello, ladies. You're listening to Dr. Covers. How are you? In 2009, they released the album The Resistance, which explored themes of civil uprising and government oppression.
So,
go ahead.
The uprising sounds a lot like Doctor Who with a little bit of Call Me guitar thrown in. That, man, ow! Sounds like.
Yeah, 100%. As a matter of fact, I want to say that somebody did a mashup that incorporated all three of those, that incorporated The Uprising, Doctor Who, and Call Me, and I'll bet you'll find it, and I'll bet you'll insert it right here.
Probably. If I can, I will.
Okay. While recording the album, Wolstenholme checked into rehab because of alcoholism. This gave him the third straight number one in the UK and reached number 3 on the Billboard 200 charts. Song on here, the United States of Eurasia. Again, you know, I talked about a Lost Queen song on the last album. United States of Eurasia is yet another one, but you mix it with Kashmir. And if you don't believe me, listen to it again. It's got the Queen stuff, and then it's got that walking... that walking chord progression that begins Kashmir, that da-na-na, 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 da-na-na. It's so cool and such great.
So it's interesting you know,
whether
mentioned
or not
so
it was
much,
an influence.
It's interesting you mentioned so much Queen stuff because coming up in just a few lines, it'll
right,
all
I
be
know.
Paid There's, off.
They get the there is a Queen connection here. The Uprising, by the way, was the first single and was what they performed at the 2009 Music Awards. The album also contained the 13-minute, three-part Exogenesis Symphony. Part one was used by Guy Ritchie in an ad for Dior Homme. Another song on the album, by the way, I Belong to You, another great song that I absolutely loved. In 2010, it was announced that they would be providing the lead single for the film The Twilight Saga, Eclipse. The single was Neutron Star Collision, Love is Forever.
Okay, well, every band has a bump in their career.
you know, and the song's great.
No, I'm not. Yeah.
And you know, the road of great songs in bad movies is a full one.
Oh,
like
yeah.
There's no shortage of those. And, I forgive a band. I forgive a band for including a great song on a bad soundtrack more than I forgive an actor for appearing in a crap movie. Because they actually had some influence on whether or not the movie was crap, whereas the soundtrack.
Okay, so here's a question. Could Muse do a theme song for Bond film?
100%. I feel like I feel if they are not in the short list of performers to record for the next Bond film, I will eat one of my funny hats.
Okay. Well, knowing that they're on the list, we'll never know. So you're
safe. We'll never know, but if it gets announced that Muse is doing the theme to the next Bond film, then I definitely won't be eating my hat.
Yeah, no, it just feels like it'd be a great fit because the way they do music and the way they kind of it's orchestral and rocky.
It is.
It's perfect.
It's a perfect fit because you want something bombastic and extravagant and orchestral for the beginning of your Bond movie. Mm-hmm. And they've got that in spades. Mm-hmm. Like 90% of their songs have that and could be used as a Bond theme. So the Queen connection we mentioned earlier, Roger Taylor and Brian May called Muse, referred to them as, quote, probably the greatest live act in the world today.
Which is high praise.
Oh, it is totally high praise because I would consider Queen one of the greatest live acts I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I saw them this last summer with Adam Lambert, and it was a great performance. And to hear them say that Muse is great, dude, it gives me so much excitement for the concert next week. I can't wait, man. I can't wait.
It's a blizzard of activity.
Right, it's a blizzard warning. In 2012, they released The Second Law, and like the prior album, continued looking at political and societal issues. The first single from the album, Survival, was the official song of the 2012 London Olympics, and they performed as the closing ceremony, or performed as part of the closing ceremony. Madness was released as the second single, and later was nominated in the Best Rock Song category in the 55th Grammy Awards. And they played the song Supremacy at the 2013 Brit Awards, along backed by an orchestra. A fourth live album was released in 2013 called Live at Rome Olympic Stadium. It was released on DVD and Blu-ray and on CD, also had theatrical screenings in 20 cities worldwide, and it was the first concert ever filmed in 4K. And that kind of cemented their role as one of the major stadium acts in the world.
That and Queen saying you're one of the best stadium acts in the world.
Doesn't hurt. Certainly doesn't hurt. In 2015, they released the album Drones, one of my favorite album covers. Love that album cover. It was a concept album about, yeah, you guessed it, drone warfare, the dehumanization of modern warfare. This also saw them returning to a more traditional hard rock sound.
So, okay, that song Psycho. Some very heavy fingerprints of Marilyn Manson throughout that one. There's something very Manson-y about that song.
It's a very Manson-y. Yeah, I would agree with that. They also brought Mutt Lange in to produce so that they could pay more attention to playing. They have self-produced the last two albums. Psycho, as we mentioned, and Dead Inside were both released as singles. A bonus DVD was included with the album that included some live performances and studio footage. And this album topped the charts in the US, the UK, and Australia, as well as some other major markets. In 2017, they announced another US tour, and they were also working on new material, one of which was released, or one thing was released in May, a new single called Dig Down. And you told it's the end. You must find a way. When God decides to look the other way. The rest of the album is scheduled for next year. And as we mentioned, and as I've mentioned several times, the band is scheduled to play at BlizzCon. I like the new single, by the way. I do really like it.
Yeah, I do too. So, you know, usually, so when they pick bands for BlizzCon, are they usually Blizzard fans, or are they just picking bands that are they want to hear play?
It could be a little bit of both. I mean, they're picking bands that feel like they'd be a good fit. And it's funny because, you know, they've had Foo Fighters and Metallica and Blink 182 and now Muse and Weird Al Yankovic. I mean, there's not a very consistent, like, we're only picking from heavy metal acts, or we're only picking from alternative rock, because Weird Al Yankovic defies all of those genres.
He defies all logic as well.
He does. And again, it was also one of the best concerts I've ever seen, like easily in the top 10. His show is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's such a, I think I've talked about it on this show, as a matter of fact. I really like the fact that they don't pigeonhole themselves into one type of band for BlizzCon.
And I know
this feels like it's going to be, yeah.
We're going to dive into an instance kind of conversation, but I'm going to say that Blizzard is a company that tries to be, to cover all kind of appeal to all types of people. And by the way they're picking bands, they continue to kind of live through that motto.
Totally. Yep.
Okay. And that's a segment brought to you by the instance.
Right.
All right.
let's get into some statistics. And we've talked about, you know, number one albums, their popularity on the Billboard charts, but what else can you
tell? Well, I've just got a few things to kind of top that off. They've won 2 Grammy Awards, 2 Brit Awards, 5 MTV Music Awards in Europe, and then 8 NME Awards. And NME sounds like one of those bands we covered last week. NME opened for LFO and DV8.
Yeah, for sure.
They've also, and this is the thing that kind of shocked me, was they've only been around for a short time as far as some of the bands we've covered, but they've already sold 20 million records worldwide. When we've covered bands like Duran Duran and things like that, they're on track to do better than some of these bands that are more established if they keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I think so. Yep. And it's, shoot, I completely forgot the train of thought I was going to go on that. Oh, well. Okay. Well, I'm going to forget that. We're going to go right to, right to Muse in concert. You sing them in concert. And they get up on stage and perform for a couple hours, and then they disappear, and they're about to come back for an encore. And you're saying to yourself, well, yeah, they've played a lot of the songs I was expecting them to, but what about blah? What about this one song? They can't leave and not play, blah, 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 right? and we're going to fill in the blank of.
Okay, so my guess is, and this is someone who's relatively new to Muse. I owned one of their albums before this week.
Sure.
And I pick Starlight, Knights of Sidonia, Uprising, Butterflies and Hurricanes, and Hysteria.
Right. And I think Uprising is probably their biggest hit. That was their U.S. breakthrough song. I would also say I would add Muscle Museum to that list just because it's an early song and therefore would have had more times to be played in one of their millions of concerts that they've done. Actually, they've done, let's see here. How can I tell how many concerts? I mean, it looks like they've done 1,463 concerts. That can't be right, could it?
Could be.
Yeah, looks like.
Like I said, these people are on the road all the time.
They are. They are. Now, you know, I'm going to scale that back a little bit, but they do. You're right. I mean, every time they tour, it's like the European summer tour, 30 dates, the North American tour, 8 dates, UK tour, 43 dates. And all that was in 1999. So just that year alone, that was like 81 performances just in 1999 alone. And you go through the list. I mean, 131 performances during the Origin of Symmetry tour, 146 during the Resistance tour. And they just played Life is Beautiful over in Vegas as one of the headliners there. And that would have been, again, another show I would have loved to have seen. Believe it or not, so let's look at some of the ones we chose. Uprising, number 13 on the list. Muscle Museum, number 12. What else did we have in there? Knights of Sidonia was one of the ones you said?
Mm-hmm. Starlight, Knights of Sidonia.
So Starlight's number 6, Knights of Sidonia is number 7. Number 1 was not one we even had on our list, and it's
Now it's time for change and cleansing.
its play count is over almost 100 more than the second place. Plug In Baby from Origin of Symmetry is their most played song in concert. And I wonder if they use that as a specific, with a specific point in the concert, you know? Be curious to see.
Well, you'll know in a week or so.
I'll know in a week or so. Number two, Time is Running Out, Hysteria, Newborn, Stockholm Syndrome, Starlight, Knights of Sidonia, Supermassive Black Hole. That's one we forgot to mention too. Sunburn and Bliss, all rounding out the top 10 as far as songs performed in concert. And Feeling Good, you know, they're easily their most notable cover. Number 11 on the list. So I think there's a very good chance I'm going to hear that in concert next week. Any other covers? Yeah, Dracula Mountain by Lightning Bolt, New Kind of Kick by The Cramps, Man of Mystery by The Shadows, Can't Take My Eyes Off You by Frankie Valli, which I've got them, has been released as a single, Sign of the Times by Prince. All these are songs that they've done, covers that they've done in concert. Really, really cool.
Speaking of that, what would you like to hear them cover that they haven't yet?
Ooh, that's a good thing. Good question. Here's my criteria, what I'd like them to do. Something that breaks out of the electronic pop rock arrangements that they've got. I want them to cover something that is normally acoustic, but I want it to be something that really showcases Bellamy's vocals with maybe a ballad. I would say In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel would be a really good one, a good one for them to cover.
Oh, that'd be good. When you're describing it, I kept thinking you're a Throttle Leonard Cohen song.
You know what? I'd be surprised if, I mean, there's none listed on their concert list, but geez, it seems like Famous Blue Raincoat would be a great one. Everybody knows. I mean, I know Concrete Blonde kind of did the definitive rock version of that song, but that song has the perfect combination of simmering anger that I think is the hallmark of a Muse song. So yeah, no kidding. Leonard Cohen, everybody knows that would be another great one to hear them cover for sure. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they could do very well with Hallelujah, but they could definitely do like most of the songs we picked on our playlist. I think they could kill.
I think they could. Yeah. I mean, the stuff that Leonard Cohen writes where you've got the biting sarcasm and wit. Chelsea Hotel would be kind of an interesting one for them. But yeah, Everybody Knows or Famous Blue Raincoat, I think would be really cool.
Yep.
How about you? Is there anything you'd like to hear them cover?
Yeah, I want them to do Depeche Mode Stripped.
Oh yeah, cool.
I know that Rammstein did probably the definitive cover of it, but I would still like to have Muse take a whack at it because it seems like something they do very well at, or like any of the classic Depeche Mode songs.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Very cool. All right, let's get to our playlist. So seeing as they don't have a greatest hits, we can kind of be a little bit more flexible with this. I picked six songs. I haven't broken the 5-song rule in a while, so it felt really good to do that. Let's start off with my first pick, which is from the first album, or the first full album, not EP, Muscle Museum. Which is from Showbiz. The chord progression on this is just so cool. And there's a great a cappella version that I played on Coverville before where they do the whole na 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 Oh my gosh, Hammond, your ability, your prognostication abilities are just amazing. Of course I picked Feeling Good, the Nina Simone cover from the Origin album. It's from Origin Symmetry. It's great. It is it's a song that deserves to be in their most played in concert list because it's just so good. And I'm feeling good. We'll
Does it make you want to have some coffee? Some Nescafe in particular?
It does, but now I can't. So I'll settle for my Folgers. Number three is Map of Your Head from the Hullabaloo release, which was like the combination of live stuff and B-sides. This is such a different track for them. There's like an acoustic guitar line through the whole thing, and very, very simple arrangement around that. And it allows Matt Bellamy's vocals to really jump front and center in front of everything else. Number four is Thoughts of a Dying Atheist. This one comes from the Absolution album. Album is just so great, but this song, the chorus ends with this whole la 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 na 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 na, and I love that part of it. It's almost like a, I don't know, like na 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 na. Number five on my list is Undisclosed Desires. This is a song from Resistance. This actually, I think, is my favorite Muse song. The chorus from this song makes the hair on my arm stand on end, and I just love it. Before we even did this show, when I was first listening to Muse, just based on hearing The Uprising, and I picked up this album was going through it. This was one of the songs that I...
You're hoping I didn't pick?
Well, I would have deleted it from your list so that I could use it. This was one of the songs that I... replayed as soon as it was over, like went back and listened to again and again. Really, really love that song.
So I don't have that experience with music. You're now the second person I've spoken to this year who've had like a physical response to music, making the arm stand up on your arms, getting goosebumps when you hear something.
Yeah, really?
I don't get that ever. I get excited. I like enjoy things, but I don't have like physical responses. Am I really that broken?
You're broken. You're broken inside. You have no soul, Hammond.
I've been told you're not the first person to tell me that either. So
what's it like walking around day after day with no soul? I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of my sixth song on the list is Madness, which is from the Second Law album. I'm breaking my rule of the six songs, doing six songs instead of five. And while I'm at it, I might as well break the No Greatest Hits rule. I love this song, and I love the really cool the thing that they do there. I guess you put the song in, so I don't need to make that noise.
No, it's great. I love the Brian Ibbett EDM noises I've been getting.
Brian Ibbett does a cappella versions of Muse by himself. It's a great song. It's just such a cool song. I love it. So it's on my list because of that.
So I kind of felt the same way about my first one, which is the other Map song they did. Picked Map of Your Head, and I picked Map of the Problematique. I felt that way about what was it? The Undisclosed Desire. This was as soon as I knew we were doing Muse, I came in and dropped this in the list.
Nice. This is your planting your flag.
Yeah, and this is the first Muse song I heard, and I heard it because of a cover, and then I went and found the original, and I bought that album, and I really enjoyed that album. So I had to stick it on there because this was my first connection to the band. This was my foothold.
So, so Black Holes, and forgetting the rest of the title, Revelations, mm-hmm. was your first Muse album?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was, and it's, well, like I said, it's the only one I owned up until this week. So.
And you hadn't, so you hadn't heard Uprising before mm-mm. this song, or maybe you heard it and never connected that it was Muse, maybe?
I might have heard it. It sounded familiar, yeah. but it wasn't anything yeah. where I was like, oh, that's Muse. So it was, oh, this, I know this song. Now I know it's Muse. It wasn't a connection I made immediately.
Cool. Okay.
So I just had to put this in as my foothold in my entryway into the band. And then I picked Butterflies and Hurricanes. I really love the way the music transitions throughout the whole song. There's lots of changes and evolutions, and I love the way that works inside the film, or not the film, in the feeling of the song.
Right, right.
I picked I Belong to You from Resistance. It was surprising how it felt because it had a lot of acoustic piano. It was very different from what I'd been listening to that point, and it was a completely different feel. And I'd love to hear Muse do like an unplugged show, like one of those 90s unplugged shows based on this, because I think they could do some really interesting things by limiting themselves. Mm-hmm. Where was I? Oh, Panic Station. I love this one because it's like, it's a funk tune. And again, it was yeah. something that really stood out because I wasn't expecting, you know, a weird time signature funk tune from them. This sounds like
on a Muse album, right?
Yeah. yeah. I feel like it was missing a ball horn section because it needed one.
And that's the thing with bands like Muse that do have a very consistent sound to them. When they break from that, boy, is it noticeable. Mm-hmm. You know, that the map of your head, hearing acoustic guitar on a Muse song is like, oh, whoa, hey, what, you know, mm-hmm. you look over at the player to see, did it accidentally go to a different band? Mm-hmm. I'm still hearing Matt Bellamy's vocals, but what's going on here?
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed, I think Panic Station, after Map of the Problematique, might be my favorite song because it's just so unique and different for them, but it still is them, which is an amazing feat.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And then I picked for my last one, Knights of Sidonia from Black Holes. Great song. I really loved it. I liked it from the time I used to play it on Guitar Hero. So
I forgot that they had that on Guitar Hero.
And yeah. I was good at it on Guitar Hero. So there, take that.
That's cool. Wow. Gee, okay. All right, Hammond. Relax. Cool. Very cool. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this week. And I know I say that a lot, but I did really enjoy this week, and I enjoyed the variety and everything that we got from their albums. For a band that has a very consistent sound to them, there is the variety. There's the increased range on every album, like adding orchestral stuff or adding guitars, rock mm-hmm. guitars or whatever on each one.
Yeah.
So really, really enjoyed it. Next week, this is one that you've been looking forward to for a long time.
Actually, I'm not the only one. We've been getting emails and comments about this one for a long time.
Okay, very cool. Spock's Beard. is going to be our next band that we're going to be focusing on, and all their side projects and connections and things like that. There's a lot of stuff to listen to on this one, but I'm really looking forward to diving into it. Is this like Evil Spock, basically, because he's got a beard?
Yes, it is Evil Spock.
All right, just checking, because I know that's a thing.
Well, instead of our regular theme music, we might use Andrew Allen's Amok Time for our theme next week.
Right, perfect. Great. Very good. Well, I'm looking forward to that. That will be coming up next time. Hey, between now and then, you want to get in touch with us, you can do it. Many, many ways to do that exact thing that I just described. You can email us at soundographypodcast@gmail.com. You can reach out to us on Twitter. We are at The Soundography. Just like that. Or you can visit soundography.com. Everything you want is going to be right there. You're going to find a link to each of the shows where you can download and listen to every episode we've ever done. You'll also find playlists, the playlists that we talked about. You'll be able to listen to those on Spotify. You'll find a link to buy the songs on Amazon or buy the music on Amazon. Like we said, we're probably going to link to one of their live albums, maybe Harp. Seems like a good one. You had it one month.
The 2005 Glastonbury one.
That's the one.
Absolution.
Right,
exactly. Yeah.
Cool. And then, of course, a way to support the show via Patreon. We love your Patreon support. You guys are awesome. And we'd love more of it. Become our bosses. That's really basically what it is. And the more you spend, the more you get to boss us around. So you spend $50, you get to take control of an entire episode of Soundography and tell us what to listen to.
Yep. We got one of those coming up after Spock.
We do. That's right. I'm excited to get to that one too. So there you go. That's how you do it. All that stuff is at Soundography. So between now and the next show, do one of those things. Of course, you can leave us reviews anywhere you want. You can go to iTunes, leave a review there. You can go to our website, post a review, tweet us a review, whatever you want, or just email us and tell us your thoughts. We love that as well. That's going to do it. On behalf of Hammond Chamberlain, this is Brian Abbott saying we'll see you next time right here on Soundography.
Part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.